You ready to grill me?
Yeah, are you ready to be grilled?
I have been grilled quite a bit in the last year.
Whenever I doubt the utility of Twitter, I need look no further than episode 31 of the hashtag CNF podcast. This one with Jen Miller, freelancer to the hilt and author of Running a Love Story. After my episode with Pete Croato, episode 29, go download the shit out of it, Jen pinged me on Twitter saying, "I like doing podcasts too." I was like, "Well, shit, so do I." So we made it happen. So, in any case, please subscribe to the podcast and share it with your friends if you think they can glean some wisdom from the episode. And before I forget, thank you for listening. So without further ado, here is Jen Miller. Thank you. So what inspired you to pick up the pen, so to speak?
Let's see. I never thought I would be a professional writer because who does that, right? But when I was a kid, I would steal my mom's typewriter or borrow it without asking her and write stories. I wrote a sequel to The Bridge of Terabithia, believe it or not, when I was in sixth grade. I
Early
wish I still
fan
had it.
fiction, yeah.
Yeah, before they called it that, I would write short little stories, and usually when I cut the lawn, of all things, I would make up stories as I would cut the lawn to occupy my brain. And always did very well in English classes in school. I opted out of taking AP English in my very competitive high school because I thought I was going to be a marine biologist. Oops. I still write about science, so I get
Yeah.
seasick. I get seasick, so that wasn't going to work out too well, and I didn't want to spend my life in a lab. So I switched to an English major because I really like literature, and I think writing goes hand in hand with really liking literature because you have to write papers. And I joined the student newspaper because I thought that would be something to occupy my time when I went to college. I went to college in Florida and was extremely homesick. And my first story for the student newspaper was about a speaker who had appeared on campus. And the advisor of the newspaper used it as an example of how not to write a news story. He
Ouch.
didn't know I was in the
Wow. Did you just like sheepishly raise your hand and say, "Professor?"
He said as soon as he looked at my face that he knew I wrote the story, and he pulled me aside after and apologized profusely. And then I became the editor-in-chief of the newspaper 3 years later, so
So
I guess I learned something.
what did he point out about the story that was so problematic to him?
I wrote it like a five-paragraph essay or a
Oh.
five-paragraph paper. I didn't know how to write a news story. We didn't have a journalism program at the University of Tampa at the time. They do now. And there was one journalism class at the time, and nobody on staff ever took it. I think the most we got out of that journalism class was somebody wrote a letter to the editor that she wanted published anonymously. And I'm like, no, that's not how that works. But I learned by doing and making terrible mistakes, just being a bad writer. And fortunately, those archives are not online. That is, they are. They're not easily searchable, though. And I just thought, well, this is fun. But again, I never thought it was a career because who becomes a professional writer? Like, seriously, who does that? And I wanted to get my PhD in English because I thought maybe teaching would be ideal. I had spent a semester at Oxford University where two very intense literature classes where I would pretty much go write a 6 to 8 page paper a week, and I really enjoyed that. So I thought, well, let's do that for a living. And I applied to 14 PhD programs and got rejected from 13. And the one that accepted me offered no financial aid. And no teaching or anything like that. And Rutgers, New Brunswick, which is the main campus, Rutgers College, I think is what the technical name is. Sorry, Rutgers. I know I write for you, but sorry. said, listen, why don't you go to Rutgers Camden and get your master's degree in English? And then if that works out, then apply again. The Rutgers Camden is near where I grew up, so I moved home and did that. And my very first class, which was a poetry class, our professor was asked by the Philadelphia Inquirer if the students in the class would like to write commentaries because at the time, the Poet Laureate of New Jersey, Amiri Baraka, I think I'm saying that wrong, I apologize. It's been a while, was kicked out of his role as the Poet Laureate of the State of New Jersey, and they said, do you have opinions? And I'm like, I have an opinion. I had won a Society of Professional Journalism Award in college for writing editorials. So yes, I had an opinion. Again, never thinking I would do this for a living. And the editor at the time said, they ran it, and they said, you should write for us. We'll pay you. And I said, really? They said, yeah, we'll pay you. So that was the start of me being a professional writer. And here we are.
So how did you endure a lot of that early bad writing that all writers really have to do? But how did you find sort of the thickness of skin and the momentum to go through all those novice amateur drafts of anything you were doing to the point of proficiency and now to the point of being a pro?
That's a very good question. I think part of it's a personality. I'm incredibly tenacious, which my dad told me when I was 11, I think, and just hammering away at things that I probably shouldn't, including sports. I was a very short first baseman in softball, and I just didn't care, and I said I was going to play first base anyway. And it worked. I ended up being captain of my high school softball team. I've likened myself sometimes to Captain America, not because I have biceps like Captain America, but because I think he sometimes does the same thing where he will continue doing what he thinks is right, even when he knows there's no chance of it working. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure that's how my writing career took off, because when I was a baby freelancer, I was pitching national magazines without clips to back it up. And sometimes people just said yes. And when I was a student journalist, I have to say my advisor at my college newspaper, even though he was the one who said I messed up that first story, said that he thought I had the personality to just keep trying. And I was encouraged quite a bit by him and senior editors on the staff to just keep trying. And I did. And eventually it worked out. And once you keep doing that over and over again and overcoming mistakes and overcoming rejection, it just becomes part of your life. And, you know, that's sort of running too. I mean, my first marathon, I bombed, but I kept trying, and I've run 8 now and an ultra marathon. So I think that's part of my personality. And it's not that it doesn't bother me. It totally bothers me. I hate it sometimes. You know, I've had moments of wanting to kick the wall when something didn't work out, or there was a whole book deal before this book came out that went south that just sent me into somewhat of a flying rage. but I understand that it's part of the territory, and that if you don't try, you know, what's the worst they can say? No. So yeah, they can tell me no, that's fine. Actually, I think the worst they can say is nothing. but I'm just used to it. And it's worked out so far. So even in those times when something doesn't work out, or I get a no, or I get that deafening silence, I have enough experience with it to know that it'll turn around eventually. Yeah, does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. I kind of liken the rejection process to a game of tennis, where you're the one person on the one side of the net, and then there's like 10 people on the other side, and you hit one at one, they hit it back, and that's a no, and they get in line again, and then the next guy comes up, and you just gotta whack that ball right back, and eventually it's one of those things where you almost gotta see that rejection as an incoming shot that you just need to rebound right back at them. And then eventually, if you do that enough, you're going to land some stories. You can't just like pitch to, say, Runner's World and then give up when they say no. It's like you got to keep going and keep going and keep going. And I think yeah.
It took me years to break into Runner's World.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of my career has been based on me being told no. I mean, if I had gotten into one of those PhD programs, I wouldn't be here now. I did an internship in college at a news service in Washington, D.C. that was horrible. I hated it. and it taught me that I didn't want to do news. I didn't want to do hard news. And at first I thought it was a waste of time, but boy, what a valuable lesson to sort of strike that from what you want to do. Now, I've written hard news. I just don't pursue it because I don't think I'm good at it, or that it's, you know, that adrenaline junkie that my news friends have. I'm just not that person. But, you know, doing the wrong things has steered me to the right path.
Yeah, I'm the same exact way. Like temperamentally, I can do features all day long, but for hard news, forget about it. Just the idea of having to, all right, there's a fire and there's this family crying outside their house, and then you have to like go to that house and talk to these people while they're in this extremely fragile state. To me, I can do that maybe 3 days after the fact and do something a bit longer, but I can't do the stuff in the moment. I applaud the people who can, but it does not suit me. It gives me like a wave of panic over my body. I just can't do it.
Yeah, and, you know, I've never worked full-time in a newspaper, and I'm sure if I did, I would have had to do that. But I used to feel bad that, you know, I write these kind of stories. Should I be writing those kind of stories? And as a friend who teaches journalism said, not everyone can write features. You should do what you want to do and keep on keeping on.
Yeah, I've kind of come to that realization too, that maybe some of the real hard news people, maybe they look at people who do features and be like, man, I just can't do that.
No, they don't. Yeah. I'm just kidding, news friends. Please don't hate me.
So what has to be in place for you to pursue a story or what it needs to excite you? Enough?
Money. No.
Money. Money. Money.
That's an interesting question because I write often for a website called CIO.com, which is for chief information officers. And I was recruited to write for that site by a former editor there who was a runner and had read all my running stuff. And he kept saying, you got to write for me. I'm like, I know nothing about any of this stuff. And we finally found a story that I pitched. I'm like, well, I think this would be interesting to chief information officers. It was about technology used in the city of Camden to fight crime. And I wrote that story. And they said, okay, well, what about this? Are you interested in this? And I often write about things that seem like they don't interest me at all. But I find the world of like data hacking and healthcare apps and all that stuff fascinating, and what fascinates me about it is I get to learn stuff by writing it, if that makes sense. Yeah. I know a lot more about things I never would have known, and that's really the case for almost everything that I write. When I started writing about running in 2010 for the New York Times, it was because I had an injury that I didn't know enough about, and I thought, well, let me write about it, and then I'll get paid to explore it. It also had the name of dead butt syndrome, right. Which when the doctor told me that I had that, I'm like, well, that's a story, and I sold it immediately. And I've been writing for that section of the Times for 6 years now. So there's a lot of things I write about because I want to know more. And that's pretty much it. And then the business end of freelancing, you know, paychecks and contracts and all that sort of stuff is important too. But I'm just curious all the time. You know, people said, oh, you became a running writer because you knew so much about writing, running. And I said, no, I didn't know anything. And that's why I think I was the best person to ask a lot of those inquisitive questions.
Yeah, there's the one school of thought that's like, all right, write what you know. But I'm kind of like the opposite. Like, why not write what you don't know? That way you go in as a blank sheet of paper and you go in and you can free willing ask the stupid questions because you don't know. And frankly, if you're talking to these experts, they're more than happy most of the time to inform you and educate you on what they do. It's kind of like this mutual give and take. And then you get to convey that to a reader. So I think it's like what you're doing is exactly right. Like write what you don't know in that way and let your curiosity drive your reporting.
Yeah, I wrote a story a couple years ago called The Lion Sleeps Tonight for a publication called The Magazine, which is no longer around, about a safari park that Warner Brothers Studios built in northern New Jersey. I had no idea what it was all about. I read it about it in another friend's book. And I pitched it pretty much saying, I need to know more about this. I need to know everything about this. And my editor's like, okay. And then I wrote the story. So my curiosity and enthusiasm for finding out more, I think, was what made that story work so well.
So how has your strategy or your approach to pitching changed over the years? I imagine like early on, it has to be a lot more in depth. In terms of hiring, and maybe with some of the people you're not familiar with, you still have to approach it that way. But I suspect now that you've forged a lot of relationships, that pitches are a lot more like you could almost tweet at an editor, hey, here's an idea for a story.
I have done that.
So like, how has that changed for you over the years?
Well, when I was new and didn't have the clips to really back up what I was saying, or when I started, not everything was online and you had to mail clips. I would just write very long queries and I would do more. I mean, I still do research before pitching now, but sometimes I would just pretty much write the story, which I don't really recommend. That was probably a mistake, but yeah, I just wrote longer queries and could show that and wanted to show editors, I know what I'm doing. Here's why. Now I've been freelancing full time for almost 12 years. Yes, you're right. I don't have to do a lot of that heavy lifting, especially with publications that I've written for and editors that I've worked with. You know, when I said that I've written for this section of the New York Times for 6 years, I don't have to do the super long queries anymore. I'm a known entity. I've been in their offices. I've had coffee and lunch with them and written how many stories? I don't know. With people who are new to me, yes, I still fall back into the longer queries. Although now sometimes I will tend to introduce myself at the start of the query to show them, hey, I do this. This is what I do. I'm not, you know, some random person off the street. I mean, I technically am, but
right.
I have experience doing this and here's my pitch. So I usually flip it now. Since I've been in the business for so long and I have a backload of clips like that are good, I hope, I just introduce with, I am the qualified person and then here's my idea. And sometimes they'll reply saying they don't want that idea. However, do you want to write this story or what other ideas do you have? Because it's just, you know, there's a level of professionalism that I hope that I exude. I hope.
Yeah. So freelancing like clearly isn't for everyone. And I wonder, I wonder what about it resonates with you as a freelance journalist?
Well, I taught a class about this at Temple University a couple years ago, and it was a master class of mostly older students. And I told them at the beginning of the class, you know, this isn't for everybody, and please don't feel bad if it's not for you. Because I'm very adamant that freelancing is the perfect career for some people. And the response to that was, well, I couldn't do it. Is there something wrong with me? I'm like, no, there's nothing wrong. You have to, it's a business. It's as much as it is about writing, it's much more about a business. I spend 80% of my time doing the business end of this. And you have to be able to run a business. And that's not for everybody. You have to constantly be pitching and hustling and evaluating contracts, which a lot of people hate. I just finished watching the Gilmore Girls revival and kept screaming at my iPad about how terrible freelancer Rory was. Because she's just like wandering around with this New Yorker clip. You know, my first question was, did you sign the master services agreement at Condé Nast that basically gave away all your rights for all eternity to that company? And people are like, what? I'm like, that's the freelancing part. You know, evaluating. I had a publication who wanted to publish one of my essays for $350, which at that point, the essay was already written. It's a high-profile website. And I thought, oh, well, okay, that's fine. The story's already written. But I wouldn't agree to it until I saw the contract. And then I got the contract, and they owned all copyright intellectual property for that piece for everything that ever came from it. You have to be able to say no. And not everybody is comfortable with that. I am comfortable with it. I ended up telling the site they couldn't run my story. Because let's say something, you know, that story went viral and then somebody wanted to make a movie out of it. Well, I get exactly $0 from that. So it's part of it is, you know, standing up for yourself and asking for contract changes and going after late checks and turning down low fees. And part of it is your long game. You know, would it have been nice to have $350 in January? Sure. Would it be better to sell that essay to somebody who's going to respect your rights as a writer? Yes. And that's not the most popular take. My agent, when I told her that that site wouldn't negotiate contracts, her response was, I know so many agented writers who write for them. I said, I bet half of them didn't even read the contract. You have to be on top of all this stuff. And it's a lot of not writing and not everybody's comfortable with that. And that's totally fine. I mean, you know, would I like a steady paycheck and to not have to pay self-employment taxes? Sure. Do I like not commuting and working in my sweatpants? Yeah, I like that a lot more. So it's a trade-off. And, you know, I'd probably make more money if I was on staff somewhere. But how often do staffers get laid off? You know, it's the most – in journalism in the last 15 years, this is probably the most steady job I could have had.
So what's the name of that contract that you were specifically about the – you know, the rights to reprint and so forth that you requested from that website.
They wanted a work for hire. And I have only signed work for hires in instances where I'm writing for alumni magazines because it's not stuff that, or I'm ghost writing for something. Now they pay me well for that. But it can come under a couple different names, but work for hire typically is we're going to pay you a fee and then we own the content. And there's usually a nasty thing called indemnification clause in there that if they get sued over what you wrote, you have to pay all the legal bills for the publication. And and the way that this contract was also written was they had the right to change anything and everything in the piece without telling you. So how can they change something? And then if you get sued, they don't have any legal responsibility. you know, I've written for a lot of publications that have been more than happy to change their contract, or there's another contract just sort of sitting there that you have to ask for. You have to be smart enough to ask for. But I can't sign stuff like that. It's too risky. And
What's that other one you had to ask for?
The indemnification clause.
All right. I thought that was just something like sort of embedded in.
It is.
The contract.
It is.
Okay.
Yeah, it typically is.
Okay.
Those are the things I zoom in on.
Gotcha.
What are the rights that I'm selling, and what's if there's an indemnification clause? There was one contract that I turned down because it was all rights. They had an indemnification clause, and they said you could not disparage anybody involved with the magazine or their relatives for the rest of your life. Jesus, no.
Yeah. Well, so all right. So we've established that 80% of the time is more business stuff, and you already laid out a lot of really good stuff about contracts, stuff that I don't even know. What are some of the other administrative tasks that that you have to do, but also take a lot of time away from writing and reporting, which is what a lot of people go into freelance journalism thinking that, well, that's all it is.
Pitching, mm-hmm. because that's writing, but that's also pitching also involves researching the publication, finding out the appropriate editor, and sometimes that's as basic as looking at the masthead and knowing the email formula for the publication, and sometimes that's networking with other writers. So pitching can also be going to writing conferences in New York City or San Francisco. It wasn't San Francisco, it was Berkeley a couple years ago. And just staying in touch with other writers and talking to other writers about their experiences at publications so you know who's good and who to avoid. Invoicing is important. I always invoice with the story so that they got the story. I know they got the invoice and they can't say that they lost it. And a big part of this job is chasing money. Mm-hmm. I just had two publications. One of them I've worked for a long time. They're, you know, knowing that the checks were late and saying, hey, where's my money? And in both cases, somebody didn't process the invoice. If I never said anything, I never would have gotten paid. And that's a huge part of this, and it's frustrating, and I have no idea how it can get better. I have some friends who are photographers for publications who have an easier time of it, but I've found that publications tend to treat photographers better than they do writers. So I just try to be my best advocate and noisy, and I don't let publications slide on that sort of thing. And if they do, then I fire them. So
yeah,
it's a business. It's just like my family, my father works in construction and like big buildings, like the Philly Stadium and big hospitals and things like that. And I deal with the same stuff that they do, but on a obviously much, much, much smaller scale. They will fire clients who don't pay them on time or treat them poorly or treat their employees poorly. I don't have time for that.
Yeah.
I was writing for a publication for a long time when a new editor came in and just started treating me like crap, and I quit. And the owner of the publication was upset. I said, I can't work for that guy. I'll come back when he retires. And I'm still waiting. But, you know, it just released a lot of stress in my life not to have that client. It released time for me to work on other stuff, that too.
Yeah, so sometimes you find that maybe like cutting ties with that, the stress of not having to deal with people of that nature, even though you might take a little hit in pay in the early onset, it just like gives you such a better peace of mind, and then your work just tends to get better going from there.
And then I started pitching magazines that were more high profile and paid better than that magazine, and it worked out.
Yeah, so what would you say is maybe like a number one tool a freelancer needs above all others?
Stick-to-itiveness? Is that even a word? Or do you mean like a physical tool?
I think that, you're exactly right. Something a little more like that, like the tenacity you were talking about earlier.
Once or twice a year, I want to quit this and get an office job. It always happens.
Yeah.
It's usually when I'm fighting for money or nobody's paid me for 3 weeks. This sounds really cheesy, but if you've been doing this for a long time, you got to trust the process. So, and Sixers fans will get that. But belief in yourself and that you're doing the right thing. I mean, when I turned down that publication for $350, they almost tried to make me feel bad. And I knew I was right. And I was like, well, you know, nuts to you. Mm-hmm. I didn't say that, but just knowing that you're right and not letting people push you around is a big part of this. And I keep telling myself in times when I really just get really frustrated with this job, because it is incredibly frustrating, and it's been a long year with the book coming out and a book tour. Just sometimes just taking a deep breath and walking in the woods for a while and reminding myself why I do this, and then I'm okay. And then I swing my where's my money bat and get paid. So that works too.
So what are those conversations like that you have with yourself that you need to remind yourself that this is why you do it, and it brings you back from the ledge of jumping off into the 9 to 5?
Well, sometimes I go back and look at previous times when it's been hard and remind myself what happened after. So in 2013, I was approached by a very large publisher to write a book for her. It was her idea. And they promised big contract, big book, hardcover, blah, 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 blah. And after getting an agent, writing the proposal, and then revising the proposal because this editor wanted it to be revised, but everyone's saying, oh, it's fine, you're going to get this contract, slam dunk, you're going to get a big book, blah, blah, blah. This editor decided her idea wasn't a good idea. The book never happened. And then my agent at the time said she sent it around to some other publications and then quit being an agent and didn't tell me. I professionally have never been so enraged in my entire life.
Yeah.
Because it was a colossal waste of time. I felt like I was disrespected on multiple fronts. You know, I was sent on a wild goose chase for somebody who just brushed it off. And, you know, the agent at the time, this is not my current agent, said I should have felt honored that she even asked. I got $0 from the whole thing. I mean, just like I've written about this before, but, you know, lying in the bottom of the tub until when turned the water on as hot as it possibly could be and lying there sobbing until it was cold. Just decimated. And you know what happened after that? I wrote Running a Love Story, and here we are. So, you know, it's like when I'm in tough spots in races, I think about the worst workouts I had training for that race, and knowing that if I could get through that, I could get through this. And it just reminds me to keep pushing and keep moving forward.
Yeah. A friend of mine who's in was in ad sales, he was always saying that, like, no is one step closer to a yes.
Right.
So it's kind of like that same thing. All right, this person, like, totally screwed you. Well, both of them did. But that put you on a path that led you to writing your memoir. So it's kind of like, yeah, when you look back on it, be like, all right, well, those, you didn't see those dominoes were necessarily in line at the time, but it's like that missed opportunity or lost opportunity, like, turned into something that ended up being a very positive thing for you.
Yeah. And somebody said, you should thank that editor and agent. And I said, no,
no, no.
And I actually, after that all happened, I said, I would never write another book again. I actually thought I had been like, I would be blacklisted from the industry just because that happened. And I was so down about myself. And I ended up talking to an agent who does not represent my kind of work at all. She follows me on Twitter. And I said, can I just ask you a question? Is my career dead? And she's like, no, what are you kidding me? So that was very kind of her to answer my questions. And when I went out to get a new agent, I explained what happened, and nobody seemed to have a problem with it. Actually, when I went out to get an agent, I had 3 offers. So that made me feel much better. And then obviously here we are today with the book. It's been out since March. So there you go. Hooray. Nuts to you, other people who tried to bring me down. No, I'm just kidding. Just kidding.
So how do you structure your time?
Oof. Well, since I slept in today, it's probably not a good day to ask me that. I'm not that freelancer who works in her pajamas and sleeps until noon. Sleeping in today was 8. So honestly, it depends on my running schedule. When I'm training in the winter, I tend to train for longer races in the winter. And I say that having just run 2 fall marathons. So I usually will get up, walk the dog, eat breakfast, make a pot of coffee, and then work until about 10 o'clock. I write best in the morning. So I like to get up and get those golden hours in. And then I'll go run, have lunch, take a shower sometimes. I live alone and work at home. So sometimes I don't get a shower until later. Yeah. And then in the afternoon, I tend to do my administrative stuff, which also includes interviewing. I like interviewing people at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We're talking at 3 o'clock. So that's why we're chatting now, not in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And then I tend to get nudged in the legs by my dog at 4 o'clock and then walk her. And we'll sometimes answer emails or do West Coast interviews after 4 o'clock. And then I read and make dinner and read some more and go to bed. But when in the summer, when it's too hot to run before lunch, I will be that person who's out running at 5:30 in the morning. And then I just sort of it still allows me to get those morning writing hours. But just flips it around a little bit. And I tend to go to bed a little bit earlier in the summer.
So I was listening to Tim Ferriss and I believe it was Josh Waitzkin on Ferriss's podcast. And they talk about finishing the day strong. That way you have like a very good sense of momentum going into the next day. And I wondered if how do you finish your days so that you have essentially a lit fuse going into the next morning?
I finish my day by writing my to-do list for the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to try to cross as many things. Like at the end of the day, after I walk the dog, I'll look at my to-do list and think, is there some annoying thing on here that's going to annoy you tomorrow? Just do it now. And that's how I tend to not avoid tasks I don't want to do, like rewrites. Ugh. I also listen to dubstep for Run the Jewels while I do rewrites. For some reason that helps. Knowing what I'm doing the next day helps a lot. I like crossing things off lists. I'm a big fan of that. But I also like to have activities that end the workday so that I'm not working late unless, there's something I have to work late on. Sitting down to read before dinner, and then I like to cook. So those two things, because my office is in my house, so work is always here. Segmenting the day that way and having an end, a hard stop to the end of the day is helpful too.
Mm. So how did you start to level up and graduate to higher degrees of writing visibility, and what did that feel like? As you maybe took that step from local and regional to some of the more national stuff you've written for, how did you make that leap?
I started with some advice from other freelancers who've been in the business for much, much longer than me. Started at the end of every year reviewing my clients and then firing two, which might sound mean, but reevaluating and seeing who was a low performer or who I didn't really like writing for anymore or who was sort of eating up too much of my time for how little they paid. And in some cases, I would say, hey, I enjoy writing for you. However, the world being what it is, I got to increase my income. And sometimes they would give me a raise and sometimes they wouldn't. And we'd part on good terms.
Mm-hmm.
But I just, before the running book, I actually wrote two books about the Jersey Shore that were travel guides and they did okay. And I wrote a lot about the shore for a lot of publications, including, the New York Times and in-flight magazines and all sorts of places. And the publisher said, do you want to write a third one? And I ended up saying no. When it gets too easy, I need to challenge myself and make it harder again.
Hmm.
So I turned down what would have been an easy paycheck to do another one of those books. Although they changed the rights agreement, which was part of the reason I said no. And I said, you know what? I'm going to take a risk and write the big book. And I had no idea what that would be. And it ended up being Running Love Story. It's just keep challenging and pushing myself. I have an idea of where I want to be in 10 years, and I'm not going to do that by doing the same thing over and over again. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And how do you balance, and maybe you don't necessarily have to do this anymore, maybe you had to do this earlier in your career, but so how do you balance some of the higher churn / lower pay stuff with some of maybe the higher pay stuff that takes a lot more reporting and writing time, if that makes any sense.
When I was in graduate school, it was a master's in English literature with a focus in writing. They have an MFA now. But at the time, I took the focus in writing because I really liked writing. I thought it was pretty cool. And I heard a talk by a freelancer, Lise Funderburg, who's fantastic, still is. I follow her on Twitter and read her stuff. And she used to talk about work that was waitressing. It was the things that paid the bills to let you do the things that you really wanted to do that might not pay as well. And long-form journalism is wonderful, and I love doing it, but when you work it out to a per-hour rate, it usually doesn't pay well.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
It's like a cup of coffee an hour.
Yeah, so I only do one or two of those a year. And this year, I did end up doing two of them. I kept thinking that I didn't do any because I was working on the book tour. and book promotion. You know, I wrote two pieces for ESPNW. One was about how women have changed running, because more women run now in the U.S. than men. And the other was a profile of Bobby Gibb, who was the first woman to run the Boston Marathon 50 years ago. And the piece with Bobby Gibb involved me taking a train to Boston and back in one day. And from Philadelphia, that is a long day.
Yeah.
But I really wanted to spend time with this person. So part of it is, again, the enthusiasm of, I want to write this story because I believe in it, and it's not going to work out. You know, BSPNW paid me very well. But, you know, I, in a per hour rate, I would have made more money writing for CIO.com, you know, three articles for them. But part of it is just things that interest me and I want to spend more time in because I think they make me a better writer and a better person. That's the one great thing about this job, is I think I've become a better person because of it. And sometimes that means writing those long form stories, that the pay isn't as great when you work it out per hour. But, you know, I love that story, and I think a lot of other people paid attention to it too. And now when I'm pitching other stories, that's one of the clips that I share.
In what ways has this type of reporting and writing made you a better person over the years?
Oh, geez. I think I've talked to so many people from so many different walks of life and been exposed to so many things. You know, I'm a voracious reader. I think I'm on track to read 60 or 65 books this year. You know, and I think that makes me a better citizen of the world, I guess. I don't know. I just did a story where I interviewed the head of the Pennsylvania Humanities Council, who talked about how books, she grew up in a town with 6,000 people, and books were the way that she saw the world differently outside of her town. And in reporting, it's the same way. I've come into contact with people and ideas and things that I never would have in any other career in my life. And I think it's just, I don't know. I can't imagine not constantly learning. And I think, you know, there's been a lot of talk after this election about not understanding other people. And I think if we all talked more, it would be better, even if talking more made you realize how people think and how terrible it is and all the work that we need to do. Sorry, listeners, if you don't like me when I say that, but it's true. You know, I've talked to people who believe in things that I'm opposed to in every fiber of my being. But, you know, I think it's better that I talk to them than not.
So what advice would you give to your, let's say, your 30-year-old self?
So me 6 years ago.
Yep.
Oh, gosh. I was in a bad relationship, which you can read about in my book, Please Buy My Book. Hashtag Please Buy My Book. No, I'm kidding. I doubted freelancing at the time, and I doubted myself in a lot of different ways, not just in my writing. And I would tell her to just keep going and keep pushing, and you'll break through. Just keep trying. Just keep bashing your head against the wall, Jen. Mm-hmm. You'll break through it eventually. And save more money. That's the other thing I would tell her.
Yeah, live below your means.
Yeah.
Well, segueing into your book, because a lot of those themes of of keep going and tenacity play a big part in your development as a runner and a writer and as a person. I wonder, first, when people write memoir, and I've spoken to a lot of people who've written them, my first question is always, why?
Oh God, me too.
You know.
I love
memoir, and it's not a judgy question, but there is a certain, you have to wonder, all right, why is my story worth telling?
Well, and you need to be able to answer that when you start pitching agents and publishers, because everybody, you know, I've talked to so many people when I retire, I'm going to write my memoir. I'm like, well, when I retire, I'm going to be a brain surgeon. No.
Yeah.
I wrote personal essays in college, and some of them were terrible. And I kept going through my writing career, and I kept sometimes writing about myself, and I thought, well, why am I special? And sometimes it's the reaction of your editors and your readers that tell you this is valuable. I wrote some essays for the New York Times, and it was sort of testing to see if anybody cared. The first barrier was if my editor thought it was good enough to write about myself, then I wrote about myself. After the whole debacle with the book that never happened, I got a writing partner, and every 2 weeks we would swap an essay. Just an exercise in getting ourselves to both write. She was at a more beginner stage than I was. And she just read my ideas, and I kept writing about running. And I thought, well, I don't know. Maybe there's more here. Maybe somebody will care about my experiences in this and what's happened to me in my life. And I, in January of 2014, locked myself in a hotel room facing the ocean, very cold, very empty hotel, and wrote the terrible first draft of what became Running a Love Story. I mean, terrible to the point that, you know, I had a relationship with an alcoholic, and that chapter in the first draft says, this chapter goes here, and I skipped it, and I kept going. I mean, it was that bad. It was awful. I have it. I'm staring at the file cabinet where it's in. And I invested two or three days in just seeing how that went. And then I thought, well, okay. And I pulled from that writing 800 words or ended up writing an 800-word essay about running as therapy. And I sold that to New York Times. And the response to that was so huge, just from the emails and the tweets and the people I knew who read it, who saw me in person and told me things about them that I never knew. I had so many friends who were divorced and I never knew it because they were older and never talked about it. And how running was the same thing to them that it was to me. And I thought, okay, I guess I should try this. But I kept telling myself that if it wasn't a good enough idea, if nobody would care, it would never get published. Like, there are so many hurdles you have to get over to publish a memoir. To the point that when I started meeting with agents, I thought that I had to have the whole book written because that's what I was told when I was 23 and I tried to sell a memoir, and thank God it didn't get published. I'm a member of the American Society of Journalists and Authors, and at their April or May conference in New York, you can have what's almost like speed dating where you list how many editors you want to meet with for like 8 minutes. And that year in 2014, I met with agents. I met with, I think, 12 agents in one day. And I thought, well, I have a 2-page pitch for Running a Love Story, which is what I called it then, and I can't believe it actually ended up on the cover. I'm going to test the waters and see, you know, if there's any interest. I had planned to go back and write the whole book and then submit the book in full in September to agents. And the response was, no, pitch it now. We'll talk now. Out of 12, I think 6 asked to see a sample, and I got 3 offers of representation. So at that point, I thought, okay, I guess people are going to care. And then really, I let the market dictate it, because if I went through that whole exercise and nobody gave a crap, then that would have been it. I would have said, all right, I hear you. Because at the end of the day, it is a business. So and then I wrote the proposal. I finished the proposal with my agent, and she sent it out for, you know, to have editors consider it. And it didn't sell. It almost sold. It was so close to selling in so many instances that I then locked myself in a hotel room again and wrote the chapter about my relationship with an alcoholic. And that's what sold the book. Hmm. And that's what the New York Times excerpted. So, you know, tested the market, and the market responded and said, yeah, we'll publish this. Now, response to the book has been pretty positive, but there are a couple people who didn't like it. One of the reviews, it was a blogger somewhere. Sorry, bloggers. I used to blog. I shouldn't say that. Sorry. she didn't like what happened. And I said, I didn't like what happened either. I then was like, I was so mad about that because it's like a reading comprehension thing.
Yeah.
But I went back and read the review again. And part of it was, well, why does Jen Miller get to write her running story? And I'm like, because I asked. I don't think a lot of people realize how much work gets into even the stage of saying, I want to write this book. You know, proposals are long.
Yeah.
And painful. And they're rarely what the final book looks like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's that stick-to-itiveness again. I really, once I got the responses to that New York Times essay, I believed that it could be something, and here we are.
Now, when I was reading it, I was struck by, like, really, it seemed to me a book really about control in a lot of ways, like discipline for the running, but control of you over your body, or you in your career, or some of these sour relationships and how they were trying to control you. So I got this undercurrent of that throughout the whole book. And I wonder maybe how cognizant were you of that theme throughout the writing of it? Or is that just something that just kind of, kind of bubbled up on its own without any real coaching from you. It just kind of came up through the writing of it.
Well, I saw a lot of themes after I wrote it. and I went into therapy after I wrote it, because I think for a long time in my life, I just let things happen to me, and that didn't work out so well. So then I flipped it, and my mom read the book in 3 hours. She sort of knew what was in there, but didn't really. And she said, this is a feminist book. And I'm like, no, it's not. And she's like, Jennifer. And I'm like, okay, I got this. because, you know, I grew up in a fairly progressive but still somewhat old-fashioned Italian Catholic family where women are supposed to do what other people tell them to, somewhat. Not the way my mom grew up. My parents sent me to college. But still, I grew up with this idea that you're supposed to get married and have kids, and if you have a career, well, that's nice. But, you know, in trying to do that, I called it the treadmill of tradition. Mm-hmm. You know, it didn't work out for me. And when I stepped off the treadmills, when things really started to happen in a positive way, and I don't think this book would have happened if I hadn't done that, I guess. I also drank a lot. That's what the other thing that I realized after reading the book. So then I stopped doing that so much. So that came out of it too. So that was a good thing.
Yeah, I had highlighted a handful of passages, and you just alluded to one of them that I have here. Like, no one in my family had drawn outside the lines. They all got married, had kids. Sure, college, a job, and career were important, but in the early 20s only. My late 20s were supposed to be dedicated to motherhood and family. Already in my 30s, I was behind. My sister had quit her job as soon as she had her first son. The Miller kids were expected to march along in the same direction, and I had thrown us out of step. And, what was the challenge in sort of approaching that head on? I mean, you had like a whole wave of treadmill of tradition in your face, and you were still able to like dive under it and come out the way you are.
Well, I gotta say, it's still challenging a little bit, because I just, you know, Thanksgiving just passed and somebody made a joke where the punchline was, how ridiculous would it be that Jennifer got married?
Ugh.
Yeah, I know. and, you know, it's still not an easy path to walk, especially because I'm 36 now and, you're running out of time. I'm like, for what? What do you do? You know, I don't... It's a hard question, and I still get tripped up on it. You know, writing the book helped me solidify my feelings that I was correct in stepping off the treadmill of tradition. And, you know, some people who tell me I should get married and have kids have been divorced twice, too. Mm-hmm. I think that section that you read was part of the hardest part about talking to my family about this book. My mom read it and cheered. Some other people in my family read it and thought I was knocking them. And that's not the case. I think part of the point of the book, and I say I'm wearing my shirt that says feminist AF, and I think a lot of people know what AF means while I'm talking to you, is understanding that there are choices and there are different paths. I just happen to pick one that's a little bit different than what the norm is. I don't know if I'm making any sense.
Oh, yeah, definitely. My wife is kind of the same way. She's got that. Her own treadmill of tradition that she's bucked. You know, we don't want children and that, and like she has to deal with that all the time. You know,
yeah.
And finally, people are relenting and sort of have stopped like questioning her and all that. But it's been like a decade of having to like tell people that, and it wears her down. It's annoying after a while, and you know,
I had to stop letting it annoy me.
Yeah.
And just, you know, when people say stuff like that, I'm like, is my life so terrible? seriously, if I had gotten married, I'd be divorced by now. So, you know, I just live my life as it is. And I think that's the best example that there are other paths out there. And once I gave up the pressure or stopped putting the pressure on myself to be what other people thought I was supposed to be, life got a lot better. And I think writing the book really helped me say, yeah, you're right, Jen. Good job. Good job, Jen.
Yeah.
And my dog just walked in and wants to say hello to everybody.
Ah, very nice. The same Jack Russell from the book.
Yeah. She turned 15 yesterday. Whoa. She's still kicking. Yeah.
Nice.
I'm sitting in her chair. That's why she's, what are you doing?
That's great. So, I have a Jack Russell mix, and he's almost 15. So
wow,
yeah,
she is. We thought she was. Well, I thought she was a mix, and then we did the DNA test on her, and it turns out she's purebred. So good job, Emily.
Nice. So, like, what surprised you most in the writing of the book?
Oh dear, I knew it would be a long process. Because I tend to write lots of drafts. I wrote probably a dozen drafts of each chapter. I show people when they say, they said, you wrote the book so quickly. I said, no, you know, there was a lot of writing that went into it even before I got an agent. And I saved all the drafts and sort of show them the pile. It was how hard it was it's how hard things were when it was done. Because, as I said, I went back into therapy because I ended up confronting head on all these things that I knew had happened to me or things I had been through, but when you write about it and then it's in your face and then other people are starting to read it and treat it, you know, like a book and edit it and questions and, you know, it was hard to confront it in the writing, but then when it was over, it was like, oh, okay. And then other people are going to read it. So that was tough. I ended up, when I finished writing the book, I hopped into my Jeep and drove the Blue Ridge Parkway, you know, a long road trip because it just, there was a lot of stuff there. And I'm sort of flubbing this one. So I didn't expect to have that. I expected the writing of it to be hard. I didn't expect the after of it to be hard. And I'm glad that people say, are you glad that you wrote it and got all this stuff out and told people about the stuff that happens in your life? I said, yes, absolutely. Because it sort of helped me finally put the nail in the coffin on saying that happened. Okay, moving on. And therapy helped with that too. So I didn't expect that outcome. I also didn't expect to have nightmares before the book was coming out. I did. Actually, before the New York Times excerpt came out was when I had the most nightmares because people sort of knew I was writing a book about running. They're like, oh, it'll be fun. Jen's funny stories. And there are funny stories in the book, but there's a lot of seriousness too. And there was a point where I had a dream that runners all dressed in neon came into my bedroom and were stabbing me.
Ooh.
And I'm a vivid dreamer. And I snapped, my head snapped back and hit the headboard on my bed and I gave myself a concussion.
Holy shit. Wow.
Yeah, and I tell that story because it happened as I was training for a marathon. So, because I ran the New Jersey Marathon again, which is the main race in the book. I ran it in 2016. You know, it's writing is physical. It's mental and it's physical, and it's draining on both levels. I'm glad I did it, but you know, my agent and I have been talking about the next book, and I'm like, can the next one not be about me? she said, well, it's always going to be somewhat about you. I said, well, I've already told that story, so that well is dry.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
How did running help and hinder you throughout the whole process of the maybe the story of the book? You know, at some point, it's also medicine, but also poison a lot of the time.
I did not train for a marathon while writing the book because I do like myself. it would take up way too much time. I write better when I'm training hard, but there's a certain level where that doesn't work. So I think the longest distance I ran while I was running the book was a 10 miler or a half marathon or something like that. You know, it's with anything, it's a balance. I find when I'm running the most and writing the most, other things suffer. Usually it's my friendships and my relationships suffer, and I just have to be careful of not like sheltering myself in my house where all I do is run and eat and sleep and write. I ran an ultra this September and I thought, well, maybe that'll be too much and it'll affect my writing. And it really didn't. I've reached a really good balance with both. And I think part of that too is that I work from home. So, you know, I don't lose time commuting. I can run in the middle of the day. I can take a nap in the middle of the day. I don't know how people who have office jobs train like I do. It's beyond me. But I've been running for so long, and it's such a part of my life that I can't imagine not doing it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And running is a place where my brain can expand because I'm not staring at a phone or a computer. And I've been running a lot lately without – I tend to listen to podcasts when I run. But I've been listening to nothing lately, which has been great and something I should probably do more of just because it, you know, my brain is all mixed up sometimes. And best way to unmix it is to go running and let my brain wander and figure things out on its own.
Running in a lot of ways is just very meditative too. So
yeah.
Do you find that you have a lot of your best ideas come while you're mid run or something that you need to jot down?
I do have a lot of ideas when I'm running. I also have a lot of ideas when I'm in the shower.
Yeah.
Which I tend to run out of the shower and sometimes slip or skid on the floor. I actually have a lot of ideas right before I fall asleep. Mm. So I've gotten better at telling myself to wake up and type them into my phone. But running puts me in the same kind of dream state too, where if I don't have my phone with me, I try to run home and write it down, then we'll maybe go back out and run again. But when I was writing Running a Love Story and I was running, you know, because it's just part of my life, I would keep running even though I wasn't training for a marathon, I would stop and write stuff into my phone. And during that time, I made sure to have my phone with me because when I'm revising too, I find that more flashes of what should go into a revision come to me than ideas do when I'm running, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Huh.
It's the honing of the imagery that happens to me when I'm running more than the actual idea.
Mm-hmm. And before I kind of let you go here, because I want to be respectful of your time, of course, I want to ask you, like, where does your, as a writer, freelancer, author, like, where does your optimism lie?
Hmm. You know, I graduated college into the dot-com recession right after 9/11. And my freelance career really started to take off during the Great Recession. So I've been, and media is sort of trying to figure out how to deal with the internet still. So it's not been a stable time, I don't think, at any point in my career to be a writer. But the way that good ideas still find homes, good books still find homes, and I've still been able to manage a pretty good life out of this, that's where my optimism lies. You know, I want to eventually write more books than I write articles. And sometimes I feel like that's challenging just because, again, everything seems to constantly be in flux and never be settled. And, you know, everybody talks about how terrible writing is and books and all that. And, you know, I just got to keep reminding myself that it's worked out pretty well so far. It's been hard work physically and mentally. This is a challenging lifestyle. It is. But it is the best thing that I could do with my life ever. And I just have to keep reminding myself, especially when I break out that "Where's my money" bat and ask people where my money is.
Like Negan on The Walking Dead, your barbed wire wrapped baseball bat.
It is my high school softball bat. And I used to, when I was a new freelancer and I felt bad about asking where my money is, which is ridiculous, I used to put it in the corner of my office and once a week look at it and call and write emails asking where my money is. I don't have to do that anymore, but I still have the bat, and I'm not giving it up ever.
Very nice. And where can people find you online, Jen?
My website is jenamiller.com. My Twitter handle is @jenamiller.com. That's Jen with one N, so JenAmiller.com. And that's probably the best place to find me, just because I tweet and share pictures of my dog quite a bit, and she's cute. So that's it.
Awesome. So that's it for another episode of the #CNF podcast. This was interviewed, produced, and edited by yours truly. Here is just one last call for action. Just subscribe to the podcast, and thanks for listening. Thank you. Bye.